Hi, this is Chris Costello, and I've teamed up with Michael Senoff to bring you the world's best health-related interviews. So if you know anyone struggling with their weight, with cancer, diabetes, ADHD, autism, heart disease, or other health issues, send them over to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Today we have author and Waterside Productions, Bill Gladstone. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you again today, Chris.
So you've got a lot of exciting stuff happening right now, and one of them, of course, is your new book that just came out with Jack Canfield, The Golden Motorcycle Gang.
Yeah, we're doing great with that book, and we're getting great feedback. I think we've gotten 30+5 reviews on Amazon and getting a lot of positive feedback on The Golden Motorcycle Gang, and just a pleasure working with Jack.
And it's such a neat concept, too. The whole book kind of revolves around helping the planet and just making things better.
And it's leading to other things. I've just been contacted by two other organizations that, based on the book, have invited me to participate in activities for organizing events. I'm going to be going to a conference up at ION's outside of San Francisco. I've been asked by Hay House to host a webinar. So already the book is starting to have a major impact beyond just being a book.
That's great. And now, one of the things I want to ask you about is, in your bio in the book, it says that you come from a publishing family. What's your history on that?
Well, my father founded a publishing company in 1936 called Arco Publishing. And it was a small company at the time, obviously, when he founded it, because he didn't have a lot of capital or anything like that. But it was based on the concept that he had of providing test preparation books for people. The very first one he did was, he was taking his driver's license exam and realized that people needed this information to pass their driver's test. And they gave out books at that time that did not include the answers. It was just sample questions. So he filled in all of the answers, mimeographed them because it was public domain, and started selling them, and sold thousands in the first few weeks. He had some of his college buddies go to other motor vehicle operating centers, and, you know, he had a little business. And then he was thinking, what else could he do? And this was 1936, and, you know, one of the things people were trying to do during the end of the Depression was find work. So he got hold of the Armed Forces exam and filled in all the answers to that, and his first real bestseller of national importance was Practice for the Armed Forces Test, and he sold over 1 million copies in the very first year, and that was the basis of Arco Publishing. And he went on to become a major publisher, not just of test preparation books, but health books. He was the biggest publisher in the United States on horse books. He was very much a niche how-to publisher, and so I learned about books as products rather than books as literature.
And so early on, it sounds like he understood that concept of finding a need and then filling it.
Absolutely. And he was very innovative. He was one of the first book publishers to focus on selling books outside of bookstores. You know, he had pet books, so he went to pet stores. He had all kinds of health books, and he went to health food stores. And so he really was a pioneer. And, you know, of course, every publisher does that today. But back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s when I was growing up, you know, that was quite innovative.
Now, did you help your father in his business?
Well, I was a bit of a math prodigy as a young child. So from the age of 6 on, I was working with the company as the editor on the math problem. So whenever a reader would write in and find a mistake in the book or think they found a mistake in the mathematics sections of these books, I was the person who made the final determination, sometimes as young as the age of 7 or 8, as whether the book was correct or the reader was correct. So that was my first introduction. But then, you know, I went on from there and did really everything that you do in a publishing company. We even had a little bookstore when I was 15. I managed the bookstore for a summer. I think I had more products stolen than sold because it was in Manhattan, where things in those days were a little difficult to monitor. But I also worked in the accounting department. I worked in the sales department, editorial. I even worked in international sales. I went on a sales trip and actually was very successful because at the time I was by now in my early 20s, late teens, to Japan, and actually closed a deal for 25,000 copies of How to Study for English as a Second Language, the TOEFL exam. The Japanese were very impressed that the company had sent an individual. I was actually there at the time because I was also moonlighting in the film world and was working actually for Rod Serling at the time as the advanced coordinator for In Search of Ancient Mysteries. But so between my film background and my father's company, I had quite a exposure to the world of media at a very young age.
Is his company still in operation?
Yes, the company was sold in 1979 to Prentice Hall, and then I'm not sure exactly when they sold it, but they sold it to a company in Nebraska, and then that company sold it to a company called Peterson's, and then I think Peterson's has sold it again. But the company's still around. You know, test prep books go on forever. They're no longer the largest test preparation book publisher. You have people like the Princeton Review and Kaplan that have come along and done much bigger and, I guess, better. But, you know, my dad really ran the company not to make as much money as he possibly could, but to have an enjoyable life. He got the company up to about $13 million in sales, which is a good income for a modest-sized book publishing company. But he wasn't super aggressive in wanting to grow the company into a $100 million or billion-dollar entity. That wasn't his goal. In fact, he had two bays on 18th Street where the company was based in a small warehouse, and that real estate was worth quite a lot. But he used one of the two bays just to park his car so he wouldn't have to walk too far to his office. So, you know, he was really more about enjoying life and making good deals and having fun than just focusing on making the most money he could.
And it seems like he imparted that to you also.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very much like him in that I like to do fun, creative things. And, of course, we like to make money. I mean, without money, it's very hard to live in the modern world. You need a decent amount. But you quickly reach a position in life where you realize money is not the key to happiness. There's other things that are actually more important as long as you have sufficient money. And I actually, because I do deal with some very, very wealthy people, I'm aware of people that literally are billionaires and aren't nearly as happy as I am. I think once you have your first 10 or 20 million, to spend a lot of time focusing on making more money is kind of a foolish thing. But some people do, and everybody is different. But certainly I was brought up to enjoy life and to examine all aspects of what it is to lead a fulfilling life.
And one of the things you've done that just incredibly well, we thought, was the movie that you've produced and written, Tapping the Source.
Absolutely, and it's interesting, and this is the first time I've spoken about Tapping the Source in this context, but the key question that I asked, actually, and we did have some billionaires in that movie and other very, very successful people, both in the business world and the entertainment world, but the question that I asked people was not, how do you make all your money? I asked, what's the key to your personal happiness, and how do you stay connected to that source of happiness on a daily basis? So that's always been, to me, a much more important question. Of course, along the way, it is fun to succeed in whatever you do, and there's a lot of things you can choose to do that will generate large sums of money, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm just saying that's never been the most important focus. And even the people that we interviewed in Tapping the Source, people like Dean Graziosi, whose company grew from $12 million to, I think, $180 million in less than 2 years, has stated that it wasn't until he realized that he was really allowing not just himself but everyone who worked for him to live in their highest and best way and give their greatest gift that his company really mushroomed to that level. And I think that's the kind of focus that Tapping the Source imparts to people. And yes, one of the byproducts will be the creation of, in some cases, superabundance on the money side, but not because someone is so concerned about just making money.
Right. And one of the things that's striking about the movie is it really does make you want to go out and do something, even if it's small, to make the world a better place.
You're absolutely right. What we learned with Tapping the Source was that the key ingredient to happiness was first to be grateful for what you already have, because no matter what your situation is, you're breathing. You're alive, and that in and of itself is something to be very, very grateful for. And hopefully most people have a lot more to be grateful for than that. But once you're grateful, the next most important element in being happy is to be of service to others. And we interviewed so many people from so many different fields, and none of these people were present at any of the interviews of the other people. And they all basically were saying the same thing. And that was what was so fascinating for us when we were filming Tapping the Source. We really felt that the source itself was making our movie for us, because we had people in Sedona, Arizona, finishing sentences that had been started by somebody in Hawaii or in Mexico. It really was unusual how everyone, once they were focused on what they felt was the biggest gift they could give to the audience, how similar the messages were from such a diverse group of people.
So it wasn't scripted.
No, not scripted at all.
Wow, that's amazing. I actually thought it was.
When you look at it, you think that it was, but yeah. It wasn't. That's what was so amazing to us. I didn't even intend to produce the film. It was an accident. I got tricked into it in a innocent enough way. Somebody else wanted to make this film and was going to finance it, and then they had a conflict at the last moment and dropped out, and I had already interviewed 20 of my closest friends and clients, people like Dr. Irvin Laszlo and Patricia Aberdeen and Marcy Shimoff, and, you know, I had told them we were going to make this film. So I really finished making the film more from a sense of, well, I don't want to disappoint the people who have already given us their time to be interviewed, rather than, oh, I think I'm going to make the next Secret and I'm going to make a lot of money. That wasn't our motivation. Of course, we would love to be the next Secret and sell 3 million copies, and we have a long way to go to sell 3 million. But we just feel very good about the way the movie came together. One person led to another person to another person. People got very excited about it, and things happened that were truly magical. We were at a party on Kauai over the 4th of July at the Bronson's house, the actor and his wife, and we saw these fire dancers performing, and I mentioned to Gail Newhouse, who's the co-producer, oh, it would have been great to connect with them and get them in the film. And the next day, we're doing an interview on another part of the island with a young man who had a chocolate farm. And we're talking with him, and I don't know, I think just inadvertently I mentioned these wonderful fire dancers I had just seen the night before. And, you know, relatively small island, maybe you know how to get in touch with them. He says, know how to get in touch with them? The lead dancer that you've described is my girlfriend. Sure, I'll get her up to your place to do an interview tonight. So things like that kept happening in the filming of Tapping the Store. So we really do feel it was a magical experience for us as filmmakers. And the feedback we've been getting and the awards we've been winning, the film is pretty magical for the viewers, too.
This is Chris Costello reporting for Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
That's really amazing because I thought it was scripted. I thought, how did they get them to sound so sincere?
Well, that's what we did. We really wanted each person just to give what was most in their heart as if they were speaking with their own family, and people did that, and we were just moved to tears in some cases during the interviews, and just some fascinating people that aren't well-known are also in the film, some artists and some young musicians, so it's almost a family, we feel, of people. We're over 130 people that we interviewed, and we were actually able to get 112 of them into the film.
You know, we should mention you have written a book, Tapping the Source.
Yes, that was the inspiration for the film, and people should understand, unlike most books, films, it's not based on the book. It is based on the thinking of Charles Hennell, who created the Master Key System, which was the inspiration for Tapping the Source. Tapping the Source, the book, is really bringing the Master Key System that Charles Hennell wrote in 1911 up to modern time. We hired John Selby, who's an excellent writer and meditation teacher, to take what Charles Hennell had taught almost 100 years ago and modernize it for today's busy world. And so we took the 21, or I think it might even have been 24 or 25 lessons that Charles Hennell was teaching, and we reduced it to 7, and we created focus phrases, and that book is still selling very well. And the main reason is people are really using Tapping the Source as their introduction, for those who have never meditated before, into meditation. My own excitement with Tapping the Source as a book really, though, is the thinking of Charles Hennell. He really was a seminal thinker. He was the first person to talk about the law of attraction. And if you want the real scoop on what the law of attraction is, you really do need to go back to the Master Key System and to our book, Tapping the Source. And Tapping the Source is all about how you can use focused attention to actually put into practice the law of attraction. A lot has been written about the law of attraction, but a lot has been misinterpreted about what the law of attraction really is and how to use it. And it really is a law of the universe, and it's not this new age idea of thinking everything will just immediately appear. It's much more connect with your essence, because your essence is connected to the source. There is a source from which everything emanates. And science has actually just in the last couple of decades proven through string theory that the idea of an A field or zero point actually is true. And one of our clients who's also in the film, Dr. Irvin Laszlo, has just written a brand new book about the Akashic Paradigm. This book hasn't even been published yet. I just got the manuscript. And in it, he is citing evidence that it is probable that scientifically we can, in fact, access this A point, which would explain unexplainable phenomena, non-local phenomena. How is it possible that certain individuals are able to gather information that from a logical point of view, they should not be able to gather. And you can think of this in terms of great musicians, and even Bob Dylan has written in his autobiography when he was writing at the height of his creativity. Where did these lyrics come from? I have no idea. And you go back to Bob Dylan, the reason he's such an icon, if you go back, he had a period of probably 3 or 4 years where every song he wrote was just magical, as if given from God. And I think that is the way creativity really works. And that's really what Charles Hennell and others have been talking about. And in my own research on the Mayan calendar, for instance, which I have evidence predates the Mayan, and we're just calling it the Mayan calendar because they were the popularizers of the calendar, not the actual creators, according to the research I've done. And the only explanation that I think is at all logical is that somehow these ancient people, because I believe the calendar was created at least 3,000 years ago, were accessing information through this A field. And how they did that, I don't really know, but it's a more logical explanation than anyone has come up with yet. So I think there's a lot to be said for tapping the source, not just as a metaphor, but as a reality, that there actually is, if you will, a physical source of all information and knowledge that we can actually tap into. And that is really the key to the law of attraction, because if you tap into that source and you resonate with that source and then start giving out from your own connection to the source your most positive energy, you're clearly going to attract back equally positive energy. So it's not about necessarily attracting back money, but attracting back positive energy, which will include money if that's part of what you need at that time in your life. And many people misinterpret and think that it's merely about money, or really misinterpret the importance of money in their lives. Obviously, it's better to have money than not to have money, but I actually have personal experience of having lost millions of dollars and only learning years later that it was actually in my long-term best interest to have lost that money. And so my personal experiences very much parallel what I've learned from Charles Hennell and the other people that we interviewed in Tapping the Source. And there's, for me, a continuity between my original novel, The 12, where I had information that I received in a near-death experience, the experiences I had through Tapping the Source, and what I've been learning working with Jack Canfield on the Golden Motorcycle Gang. And I'm absolutely confident that there is a grand design, if you will, to the universe itself, and that there actually is a very positive reason that some of the negativity that we experience as human beings happens to us, and it is not for bad reasons, but actually for good reasons. And I get a lot of debate on this. You know, you're a Candide character, you're too positive, you're too optimistic. And I will admit that my personal life is no different than anyone else's. I do have moments where things go wrong, and we all do. And I'm not immune to the great deal of suffering that's going on in the world today. But at the same time, I think there's a larger perspective that is, in fact, more accurate, where the universe itself is a joyful universe. And the more you connect to the source, the more you're going to connect to that inner feeling of joy, which really, I believe, permeates all of matter and all of life, not just on planet Earth, but throughout the universe.
For more interviews on health, mind, body, and spirit, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
So, Bill, I love that attitude, and I know that from talking with you before that a lot of this comes from the near-death experience you had when you were only 15 years old.
Correct. A lot of it comes from that, but that experience was more an affirmation of what I already knew. It's interesting, because in the beginning, my near-death experience did not have nearly as much impact as it has now. Because when I originally had my near-death experience, everyone that I told the experience to tried to talk me out of believing in the experience, because this was back in the 60s, and it was before Moody had written about near-death experiences and before it was really accepted as real. When I had my near-death experience, people tried to convince me that, oh, the oxygen had been cut off to your brain, you were hallucinating, et cetera, et cetera. But the experience that I actually had was so rich, I experienced the greatest sense of joy and bliss that I've ever experienced. And I wouldn't say that I've ever experienced as a human being, because what you learn, or at least what I learned, and what other people who've had near-death experiences have reported is true for them as well, is that you're more than a human being. Your human existence is real and obviously is the most important element in your time here on planet Earth in the body that you have, but you exist beyond your body. That was made so clear to me that it's just not something that I could ever be dissuaded from. I did, being only 15 at the time, stop talking about the experience. It wasn't doing me any good to try to impose my reality on anyone else. And, you know, I just was quiet about it. But I was never letting go of the reality of that experience, even though people that I respected tried to explain to me that I couldn't possibly have experienced what I did. But I've now worked with other authors who have written about near-death experiences, one of whom, Robert Kops, over in the Netherlands, has interviewed over 1,000 people. And I've also worked with some people who have done scientific studies on a prominent heart surgeon, had, I think, over 12 patients who have had near-death experiences, because that is a time when people are very close to death when they're being operated on. And some of them have died and come back, and they've had descriptions of seeing everything in the room, including what the doctor was doing while they were under drugs, and not possibly from a logical, normal human perspective, able to perceive what was going on. So we have very solid scientific information now that near-death experiences are real, and that there is, as another one of my friends and clients, Dr. Gary Schwartz, says, the survival of consciousness after death. Your consciousness does survive beyond your body. And this is really startling, and a lot of people do have trouble with it. My own father was a chemist before he became a book publisher, and I remember when he was sort of dying, and he was not a believer. He was like, well, as a chemist, I can tell you I know exactly what's going to happen to my body. It's all going to disintegrate back into the chemicals, and when you're done, you're done. And, you know, that was his reality, and I certainly couldn't persuade him otherwise, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who share that view of we're just material beings, and when the material of our body is gone, it's gone. But my own experience is not that. And I don't necessarily have any major world religion that I adhere to. I was raised Jewish, but not really engaged in the religion. I lived in Spain, so I lived with a Catholic family and certainly appreciate all of the beauty of the Catholic Church. I took refuge because I was meditating in a group that was Buddhist. So I actually taken refuge and done Buddhist meditation. And I actually made a film in search of the historical Christ where I filmed Hindu swamis, the head of the Greek Orthodox Church, the head of the Amidai Church, and many other religious leaders, including the Dalai Lama. And I embrace world religions, but my own experience is quite personal and beyond any specific world religion, though not in conflict with what I would call the spiritual side of these religions. But my own feeling, and I write about this in the novel The 12, is that no single world religion has a monopoly on the truth of true spiritual experience, and that what is best in each world religion is actually very similar. And I would just love a day when the focus was not so much on the difference between the Muslim experience and the Christian experience and the Hindu experience, but on what is similar. Because at the basis of all these religions, there is the actual experience of the divine. And that is really what we need to focus on if we're going to create a world that is not in conflict, but in harmony.
And Bill, that's really interesting that one thing you mentioned was that you had this awareness, this kind of attitude, more than attitude, before the near-death experience. How did you get that?
Clearly, it was something I was born with, and this is why I connected so much with Jack Canfield when he told me the story of the Golden Motorcycle Gang, and why, for me, it was interesting, because Jack told me the story of the Golden Motorcycle Gang almost 20 years ago, and he just told it as a story, and that was that. And every time I saw Jack after that, I'd say, Jack, have you thought about, you know, I know you're doing all the chicken soup for the soul books. What about the Golden Motorcycle Gang? Have you done any of that? But it was really my focus on that, because the experience that he recounts in the Golden Motorcycle Gang was similar to what I intuited as my own experience. And basically, in a nutshell, the Golden Motorcycle Gang is the story of Jack viewing himself as a spiritual being riding with a bunch of friends through space on Golden Motorcycle Gangs and peering down and seeing a small blue planet in distress, which turned out to be planet Earth, and deciding that he and his friends should incarnate as human beings and help out like a good Samaritan would in seeing a car wreck and see if they could help. And my own sense was I was here not for any reason related to my particular personality, but to somehow serve to assist this planet towards a higher level of awareness. Because as a very young child, even though for some strange reasons, including having a very violent schizophrenic older brother, I didn't speak, but I was thinking a lot, and I was thinking mostly with numbers. I had the ability as a very young child to multiply three-digit numbers in my head and to actually imagine the nature of infinity and things that I've been told by Piaget and others someone that age couldn't possibly do. But again, it was my reality. And I remember very clearly at the age of six, after one particular horrific incident with my older brother, of actually taking a dull butter knife and thinking, I should just end it all. I'm never going to be able to live up to my full potential of what I came here to do. Then, of course, I didn't do myself any harm and went back to being a little kid and getting along the best I could with this irrational older brother being. But I clearly had this sense that I was here for a reason. I didn't know what the reason was. And frankly, most of my life, I didn't know what the reason was. I think I do know now. It's why I wrote my novel, The 12, and it's why I wrote The Golden Motorcycle Gang. And I am seeing connections now with other people, including Jack Canfield, Barbara Marx Hubbard, and many, many other people who really are focused on sort of what is the plan and let's get on with it, because it's really up to us collectively to turn things around and ensure that this planet 1,000 years from now is still the paradise that it's intended to be. And I believe that is an actual possibility and even probability, and that the challenges facing us today, though they seem daunting, are not nearly as difficult as the press and the popular media makes them out to be. I think that human beings have tremendous capability, and what's been holding us back are very basic things such as fear and greed and bad behavior. And it's not that hard to change. You know, I think it's hard for certain people to change, but we don't have to change everyone to change the energy on this planet. And certainly, once massive changes are made in the way that we raise our children and educate our children and share the wealth of this planet, what is it, 40, 50 years, and you'll have a completely different generation in charge of this planet. And I think if we do things right, that generation will run things much more effectively than we have in the last 40 or 50 years.
And one thing that really came across with your movie, Tapping the Source, that it can start with one person. It doesn't have to be take over the United Nations. It can be one small thing. This is Chris Costello reporting for Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
Absolutely, and we're seeing this in the last 40, 50 years when you analyze the changes that have happened on planet Earth, whether you're talking about things like the fall of the Berlin Wall. That wasn't a planned major corporate takeover or military activity, or you look at even more recently Arab Spring, and yet to be determined, you know, whether this is really going to be that positive or not, but it certainly in the short term has been dramatic, the complete change of the regime in Egypt. Or you look at someone like Steve Jobs. He was one person, and he didn't even finish college. And look at the impact he had on the way we communicate. Even your show probably wouldn't exist had it not been for the Internet. And it wasn't this massive. I mean, yeah, there's a little bit of government support for the original basis of the Internet, but it was really a few individuals who created it. And everything that we're doing from a technology point of view, there are teams of people that get behind it, but the initial ideas are really from an individual here, an individual there. And you don't have to be a genius in technology to make an impact. You can also be making an impact just by being a good mother and a good citizen. So we're starting to see how things are interconnected much more than we ever realized, and that everybody's behavior affects everybody else's behavior. And we're starting to see even everybody's thoughts affect everybody else's thoughts. HeartMath up in Northern California has done some amazing experiments on the impact of focused attention to create resonance and the ability of resonance to actually change the random generator computing being done in Princeton so that we can actually see how thought alone can have an actual impact on physical reality. So there's a lot that we're learning that makes me very optimistic about the future.
Is that why people have been saying lately, oh, I just thought of you and then I show up? Is that how that works?
I think that's been going on for centuries, but yet, I don't know. That may have more to do with what we were talking about before, the A field, and an explanation for ESP would be different people sort of tuning into the same source at the same time. But it does happen much more frequently than people admit. I was just thinking about you, and 10 seconds later they call. Or I was just thinking about you, and 2 days later they're in your town when they normally live 3,000 miles away. These kinds of things are happening all the time. I refer to them as synchronicities, and we emphasize the value of synchronicities in the Golden Motorcycle Gang. Synchronicities were very important in Jack Canfield's own evolution, and certainly they've been very important in mine. And I cite a lot of them in my novel, The 12, which is, for the main character, Max Duff, very autobiographical. And almost every incident in that book was based on actual events in my life.
Wow. So that's the connection with your brother, then. That's pretty autobiographical.
Very much, unfortunately, you know, but there's a Spanish thing, that which doesn't make you fat, which in ancient days meant healthy, that which doesn't kill you makes you fatter or stronger. And I definitely subscribe to that. Anything that you can actually endure and conquer does make you a wiser person, a more compassionate person, or a stronger person. So that's the level on which I think a lot of times we need to look at negative events in our lives and see that there is a reward at the end of it, and that what we think of in a moment as negative may not be nearly as negative as we imagine, and that it may, in fact, be a hidden blessing for our higher good.
So, Bill, you're also one of the top literary agents in the country. You have Waterside Productions. You've represented such people as Eckhart Tolle, Tom Hartman, Conversations with God, Neil.
I'm still an agent, and I enjoy agenting. I have to say that as my own filmmaking and book writing is increasing, the number of new clients I take on is decreasing, but I have 8 other agents who work for me, and most of the new clients I'm sending to other agents. We just hired Jill Kramer, who was formerly the editorial director at Hay House, and she's starting to agent, and David Nelson, who was sales manager for Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch, is doing some agenting. And so we're still taking on clients, though personally I'm taking on very, very few clients and focusing really on some of the people you just mentioned, you know, the existing best-selling authors that have been with Waterside for many years, people like Tom Hartman and Neil Donald Walsh. And I enjoy the agenting. I have to say that it's a little discouraging right now for new or what we would call mid-list authors. And by mid-list, it's really today anybody who's not one of these already proven best-selling authors, because the market for the physical printed book is actually shrinking. We lost the Borders bookstore chain, and it's just harder for the book publishers to generate the same number of sales as they did even 2 years ago. Now, we do have all the e-books happening, but e-books are sold at a much lower price than hardcover or paperback books. So the total revenue being generated is not necessarily greater, at least in terms of the author's share of it.
But there is still the guy that sold 1 million in 6 months.
Oh, of course. Well, there's always going to be the one in 1 million that sells 1 million. I mean, it's like winning the lottery. But the reality is, it is, particularly with today's technology, where literally millions of people, I think, are putting books out. Maybe it's not one in 1 million, but it's probably more like one in 100,000 books actually sell 1 million copies, which is not that unusual when you think about it, but is frankly discouraging. A lot of people set out writing a book and they imagine selling at least 100,000 copies. Well, there's fewer than 1,000 books a year in the United States that sell 100,000 copies. So all of a sudden, on average, it varies, but if you include paperbacks, you know, an author's making between $1 and $2 a book. So if you're supporting a family and you just want to be a writer, you have to sell at least 50,000 books a year just to survive. And there's very, very few authors in America who do that. I would say the number of authors selling 50,000 or more books is probably 2,000 or less in the entire country. So that means there's only 2,000 people who are supporting themselves just as writers. And it's really much less than that, because of those 2,000, actually the most successful aren't writers at all. They're celebrities. I mean, Paris Hilton, she's not a writer, but she had a book that was on the bestseller list because she's a celebrity. And so maybe you have to cut it in half, and you're down to maybe 1,000 pure writers in this country that can actually support themselves just from their writing. Many writers teach, many writers lecture, many writers have other sources of income. But it is a little bit discouraging as a literary agent to see how difficult it is for someone to earn a competent living just being a writer. In fact, part of my motivation in becoming an agent was that I realized, because my original intent was to be a writer, that I wasn't giving myself very good odds of earning a six-figure income being a writer, whereas as an agent, I was able to agent books much more quickly than I could write them. So it was kind of, okay, I want to be involved with books, and this is something that I have an ability to do. And particularly when I started, I was really focused on all the computer books. So I did all the Four Dummies books, and even before that, Peter Norton and Danny Goodman and all the people who were creating the technology. So it was a lot of fun for me, and fortunately, we did make a lot of money doing that. But just being a pure writer or an agent representing pure writers is not an easy way to make a living.
So it sounds like authors need to really diversify, and I guess the good part of that is there are a lot of options now with the Internet.
Absolutely. Where we're making almost as much money from book representations, Waterside Productions represents online courses. We've been doing that for over 10 years, partly because of my personality. I'm always sort of looking for something new, and I get bored easily, so I'm always out there. We were involved with the first print-on-demand company, the first e-book company, the first online instruction company, and some of those things have worked very well. So I really encourage people, not just particularly if you're in the how-to space, don't just write a book, but get an online course out there. And increasingly, the traditional book publishers are offering smaller and smaller advances to all but their A-team. So unless you're able to get one of those large advances, you might be better off just self-publishing. Do it as an e-book with print-on-demand. You've got Author House. You've got Balboa, which is a division of Hay House, doing this for spiritual books. And my own company, Waterside Productions, we're starting to do that. We have over 50 titles. I've got a number of books that, you know, I thought I was going to sell for at least $10,000 or $20,000 advances. When we didn't get those offers, in this case, most of the authors I represent are people that are fairly well established in their careers. And I said, look, for a few thousand dollars, let's just at least get it out as an e-book with print on demand and see what happens. So we're experimenting with that. And I'm not saying that's the solution, but I think you have to keep trying things. And if you have something important that you really believe in and you want to get it out today, unlike 20 or 30 years ago, you can do so for really just a few thousand dollars. And if you can build up momentum and do your own marketing, most of which I think should focus on the Internet, Facebook, all the things that are happening, do it. And we're now being approached by companies that want to do what they call enhanced ebooks. That's ebooks that include audio and video portions. And I actually just finished today writing my own script for something that's going to be called The Golden Motorcycle Gang Wise Notes. And this is sort of an enhanced ebook cliff note edition of my own book. And this is something that they're going to get out for 99 cents and see what happens. And there's all these kinds of opportunities. I totally encourage people to be creative and be courageous and just go for their dream, but don't expect immediate success and don't expect to get a lot of support from the established companies that are out there. I was just interviewed by the North County Times here in San Diego, and I think the final quote they had from me, they asked me, so what's your advice to writers? And my advice was, don't quit your day job, but don't give up on writing either. So I think that is my advice. You definitely don't want to risk everything with the expectation you're going to make a fortune as a writer. But at the same time, if you truly are passionate about writing, just keep writing, and if it's meant to be, you'll find a way to share your writing with a large audience.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
Bill, so what are some of the must-dos that authors just have to do if they're going to try and publicize their book?
Must-dos that authors have to do to promote themselves. Well, they have to have a website. That's absolutely essential, and the website should be the name of their book. They have to be on Facebook. They have to get involved with Twitter. And even as I say all this, it's kind of ironic because my most successful client of recent years is Eckhart Tolle. And, of course, Eckhart did none of that. But he's kind of the exception. So I'm not saying that must everybody always do. But these are things that the more successful writers who are coming up are doing. And you need to find some marketing guru. Maybe someone like Dan Holling, he was the marketing expert behind The Secret, and he's now all focused on mobile marketing. The new thing I've heard now is it's all about mobile marketing. There's more cell phones than computers, so you've got to find a way to get everybody on their cell phone. So these are the things that you have to learn how to do. I'm not sure I know how to do them myself. I'm experimenting with a lot of different companies and ideas, and most of them, frankly, don't work, but that's the nature of progress. You have to try maybe a dozen things before you find the one that does work, And then when you do, everyone thinks you're a genius. But you could go 0 for 12. So you have to have patience and you have to have resources. You cannot expect to generate revenue immediately from your books, and you have to have patience. And the more patience and the more resources you have, the more likely you're going to succeed. And it's not necessarily the right path for everyone. If you're a young person and struggling financially, you should write, but you should not necessarily anticipate that that writing is going to give you the economic ability to live the life that you want. And so you should explore doing other things at the same time.
But I did want to just real quickly before we go over kind of the key points of the Master Key System, which you say is so important in business.
The Master Key System as a book is really an amazing accomplishment. I have to give all the credit to John Selby. I mean, John did the bulk of the writing, and he had spent over 40 years teaching meditation. And what he did in each of the original Master Key sessions that Charles Snell wrote about in the Master Key System, he had ended it with, now find a quiet chair and go and think upon these things. Well, he didn't have the language 100 years ago, but he was really telling people to go meditate. And as a professional trainer of meditation, John came up with what he calls focus phrases. And they're very simple, and they immediately, if you just follow it, there's only 7 of them. And if you just follow these 7 simple phrases every morning for 5 minutes, John, of course, recommends half an hour. But I'm a very practical person, I'm very busy, and I'm a very impatient person. I actually only spend about 5 minutes, and it works. And if you get 5 minutes in the evening, that's even better. But even something as little as that, 5 minutes, can make a huge difference. John has been very successful, and hundreds, if not thousands of people have followed those exact phrases. Once you're able to be in those states, these phrases will lead you to this state of connection to the source. In my own personal case, I can go there immediately. I don't even go through the 7 phrases anymore. So I just go to that place. But the goal will get you there either way. And once you're in that place of feeling this sense of connection, it's very hard to have a bad day. That's all I can say. You just get it and you go forth and you're going to feel great. And yes, it's like everything. I mean, it might take you an hour the first time you do it or even 2. But if you just stay with it, it's like riding a bicycle. You're never going to forget it once you reach those states and once you find whatever it is that's going to work. And I'm not one to say, oh, tapping the source is the only way to do it. Not at all. But it is an effective way. It's a way that works. And particularly for someone who may be listening to this show who has never wanted to meditate, never thought about meditating, doesn't want to be involved with some Indian guru or some other religion, just go into tapping the source. It's completely religion-free, and it works, and it captures the same essence that you would in any of these much more intricate traditions. And it's not asking you to leave the world and not focus on what is around you. The opposite. You go within through meditation so that you can be more present for your children, more present for your spouse, more present for your employer, more present for your community. It's not about retreating away from reality. It's about entering reality. So for me, tapping the source is a wonderful tool, the book. And then if you watch the film should inspire you to want to do the work. There's a little work involved with anything that's new, but I think that combination, you immediately see how rewarding it is and how successful people have almost universally adopted their own way of finding this connection, whether it's through meditation, through nature, or through some other means. And that it is this connection, this ability to tap the source, which is real, which really will change very quickly your life in a positive way.
Well, Bill, we want to thank you so much for joining us. And where can we tell people?
It's goldenmotorcyclegang.com for the novel, The 12. It's the number 12, thebook.com. So those are the sites. We welcome everybody to join the gang, as Jack says. Join the Golden Motorcycle Gang. Everyone who gets the message is automatically a member of the gang. It's not some exclusive club that you had to be born in a certain time or place or star to be. It's just a matter to realize that you are part of a larger design, if you will, and that you're here to make a difference.
Well, thanks again, Bill, and we look forward to talking with you again.
Okay, well, you have a great day.
That's the end of our interview, and I hope you've enjoyed it. For more great health-related interviews, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.